It is no simple matter for the limited subject to formulate an accurate representation of the unlimited unknown, of nature, the ground of existence. The unknown is the matrix of everything, the source of all birth, and the final place of rest. It hides behind our personal identity and our culture. It constantly threatens and engenders all that we do, all that we understand, and all that we are. It can never be eliminated permanently from consideration, since every solution merely provides the breeding place for a host of new problems. The unknown is Homo sapiens' everlasting enemy and greatest friend, constantly challenging individual facility for adaptation and representation, constantly pushing men and women to greater depths and more profound heights. The unknown as nature appears as paradoxical, formidable, overwhelming power applied simultaneously in one direction and its opposite. Hunger, the will to self-preservation, drives living creatures to devour each other rapaciously, and the hunters have no mercy for the hunted. Sexuality bends the individual will inexorably and often tragically to the demand of the species, and existence maintains itself in endless suffering, transformation, and death. Life generates and destroys itself in a pitiless cycle, and the individual remains constantly subject to forces beyond understanding or control. The desire to exist permeates all that lives and expresses itself in terrible fashion, in uncontrollable impulse, in an endless counterpoint of fecundity and decay. The most basic, fundamental, and necessary aspects of experience are, at the same time, most dangerous and unacceptable. Empirical, classical objects are either one thing or another. Nature, by contrast, the great unknown, is one thing and its affective opposite at the same time and in the same place. The novel, primeval experience was and remains much too complex to be gripped initially by rational understanding as understood in the present day. Mythic imagination, willing to sacrifice discriminatory clarity for inclusive phenomenological accuracy, provided the necessary developmental bridge. The earliest embodiments of nature are therefore symbolic combinations of rationally irreconcilable attributes. Monsters, essentially feminine, who represent animal and human, creation and destruction, birth and cessation of experience. The analytical psychologist Eric Neumann, who wrote a definitive, comprehensive, and useful book on the symbolism of the feminine, the Great Mother, states, "In the early phases of consciousness, the numinosity, that is, the emotional valence of the archetype, exceeds man's power of representation, so much so that at first no form can be given to it. And when later the primordial archetype takes form in the imagination of man, its representations are often monstrous and inhuman. This is the phase of the chimerical creatures composed of different animals or of animal and man, the griffins, sphinxes, harpies, for example, and also of such monstrosities as phallic and bearded mothers. It is only when consciousness learns to look at phenomena from a certain distance, to react more subtly, to differentiate and distinguish, this is a function of exploration and its related abstract processes, that the mixture of symbols prevailing in the primordial archetype separates into the groups of symbols characteristic of a single archetype or of a group of related archetypes. In short, that they become recognizable. The terrible aspects of the primordial Great Mother have been represented, symbolized, in a variety of manners, but her underlying reality and essential ideation remain immediately recognizable. Neumann states, "These figures are gruesomely alike. Their sheer frightfulness makes us hesitate, whether they represent a skull, the head of a snake or hippopotamus, a face showing human likeness, or a head consisting of two stone knives borne by a body pieced together from parts of snakes, panthers, lions, crocodiles, and human beings. So great is the inhuman, extrahuman, and superhuman quality in this experience of dread that man can visualize it only through phantoms. But all this, and it should not be forgotten, is an image not only of the feminine, but particularly and specifically of the maternal. For in a profound way, life and birth are always bound up with death and destruction. That is why this terrible mother is great, and this name is also given to the Egyptian Ta-Urt, the gravid monster, which is hippopotamus and crocodile, lioness and woman in one. She, too, is deadly and protective. There is a frightening likeness to Hathor, the good cow goddess, who in the form of a hippopotamus is the goddess of the underworld. She has a positive aspect, and at the same time, she is the goddess of war and death. In the course of the later development of patriarchal values, i.e., of the male deities of the sun and light, the negative aspect of the feminine was submerged. Today, it is discernible only as a content of the primordial age or of the unconscious. Thus, the terrible Ta-Urt, as well as the terrible Hathor, Isis, Nith, and others, can be reconstituted from their pictures that have been painted over but cannot be viewed directly. Only the monster Amit or Amun, which devours the souls condemned at the judgment of the dead, points by its parallelism to the terrible aspect of Ta-Urt. Amit was described as follows. Her forepart is that of crocodiles, her hinder part is that of hippopotamus, and her middle is that of a lion. The feminine animal mother character of this many-breasted creature is evident, as is that of the monster wielding the terrible knife which guards one of the underworld gates through which the souls of the departed must pass. Amit devours the souls that have not withstood the midnight judgment of the dead in the underworld, but her role has become subordinate, for the religion of Osiris and Horus, with its mysteries, has now promised rebirth and resurrection to all human souls, and not only, as originally, to the soul of Pharaoh. The certainty of magical success in following the path of the sun, which is communicated to each man after death by the priests, has overlaid the primordial fear represented by Amit. But originally, she was the terrible ancestral spirit of the matriarchal culture, in which the feminine takes back what has been born of it, just as among the primitive inhabitants of the Melanesian island of Melicula or in the high culture of Mexico. The terrible mother challenges and threatens the individual, absolutely. She is goddess of anxiety, depression, and psychological chaos, goddess of the possibility of pain and death. She is horror, insofar as horror can be imagined, and is the ground of that horror beyond. She exposes and turns to her advantage constant mortal vulnerability. She barters paradoxically, offering continuance of life for sacrificial death. She demands reconciliation without offering the certainty of survival. She embodies the potential for salvation and the central problem of life, impels the individual involuntarily toward further expansion of consciousness, or induces involuntary contraction leading to death. The Great Mother impels, pushes with certainty of mortality, and pulls with possibility of redemption, development of consciousness and of self-consciousness. The identity of death with the unknown has permanently and incurably destroyed any possibility of final habituation to, adaptation to, more accurately, the world of experience. Man, as Eric Neumann points out, is in consequence the incurably anxious animal. Thus, the womb of the earth becomes the deadly devouring maw of the underworld, and beside the fecundated womb and the protective cave of earth and mountain gapes the abyss of hell, the dark hole of the depths, the devouring womb of the grave and death, and darkness without light of nothingness. For this woman who generates life and all living things on earth is the same who takes them back into herself, who pursues her victims and captures them with snare and net. Disease, hunger, hardship, war above all are her helpers, and among all peoples, the goddesses of war and the hunt express man's experience of life as a female exacting blood. This terrible mother is the hungry earth, which devours its own children and fattens on their corpses. It is the tiger and the vulture and the coffin, the flesh-eating sarcophagus voraciously licking up the blood seed of men and beasts, and once fecundated and sated, casting it out again in new birth, hurling it to death, and over again to death. The terrible feminine has been represented by figures such as the Chimera, the Sphinx, the Griffin, and the Gorgon, which combined and unified the most disparate yet related aspects of nature, those aspects which, individually, intrinsically, inspire terror and deference. Gorgon-like figures and their sisters appear commonly throughout the world. As the Aztec Coatlicue, whose gruesome headdress was composed of skulls, the terrible mother was goddess of death and dismemberment, object of sacrificial homage. As goddess of the snake, she was sacred in ancient Crete and worshipped by the Romans. Her modern equivalents remain extant in Bali and India. Kali, Hindu goddess, portrayed in figure 34, unexplored territory as destructive mother, is eight-armed like a spider and sits within a web of fire. Each of her arms bears a tool of creation or weapon of destruction. She wears a tiara of skulls, has pointed phallic breasts and aggressive staring eyes. A snake, symbol of ancient impersonal power, transformation and rebirth, is coiled around her waist. She simultaneously devours and gives birth to a full-grown man. Medusa, Greek monster, with her coif of snakes, manifests a visage so terrible that a single exposure turns strong men to stone, paralyzes them permanently with fear. This Gorgon is a late vestigial remnant, so to speak, of an early goddess who simultaneously embodied nature's incredible productive fecundity and callous disregard for life. A neuropsychological description of the brain's response to the unexpected, such as we encountered earlier, is one thing. The mythological representation is another. Consideration of the figure of the great and terrible mother is salutary, helps breed understanding of just what it is that our cultures, that is, our ritual identification with the dead, protects us from. We are shielded from the terrors of our imagination and from the things that breed such terror by the overlay of familiarity granted by shared frameworks of action and interpretation. These walls serve their purpose so well that it is easy for us to forget our mortal vulnerability. Indeed, we generated those walls to aid that forgetting. But it is impossible to understand why we are so motivated to maintain our cultures, our beliefs, and associated patterns of action without gazing at and appreciating the horrible figures generated by our ancestors. The Great Mother in her negative guise is the force that induces the child to cry in the absence of her parents. She is the branches that claw at the night traveler in the depths of the forest. She is the terrible force that motivates the commission of atrocity, planned rape, and painful slaughter during the waging of war. She is aggression without the inhibition of fear and guilt, sexuality in the absence of responsibility, dominance without compassion, greed without empathy. She is the Freudian id, unconsciousness contaminated with the unknown and mortal terror and the flies in the corpse of a kitten. She is everything that jumps in the night, that scratches and bites, that screeches and howls. She is paralyzing dismay, horror, and the screams that accompany madness. The great mother aborts children and is the dead fetus, breeds pestilence and is the plague. She makes of the skull something gruesomely compelling and is all skulls herself. To unveil her is to risk madness, to gaze over the abyss, to lose the way, to remember the repressed trauma. She is the molester of children, the golem, the boogeyman, the monster in the swamp, the rotting, cadaverous zombie who threatens the living. She is progenitor of the devil, the strange son of chaos. She is the serpent and Eve, the temptress. She is the femme fatale, the insect in the ointment, the hidden cancer, the chronic sickness, the plague of locusts, the cause of drought, the poisoned water. She uses erotic pleasure as bait to keep the world alive and breeding. She is a gothic monster who feeds on the blood of the living. She is the water that washes menacingly over the ridge of the crumbling dam, the shark in the depths, the wide-eyed creature of the deep forests, the cry of the unknown animal, the claws of the grizzly, and the smile of the criminally insane. The great and terrible mother stars in every horror movie, every black comedy. She lies in wait for the purposefully ignorant, like a crocodile waits in the bog. She is the mystery of life that can never be mastered. She grows more menacing with every retreat. I dreamed I saw my maternal grandmother sitting by the bank of a swimming pool, which was also a river. In real life, she had been a victim of Alzheimer's disease and had regressed to a semi-conscious state. In the dream as well, she had lost her capacity for self-control. Her genital region was exposed dimly. It had the appearance of a thick mat of hair. She was stroking herself absent-mindedly. She walked over to me with a handful of pubic hair compacted into something resembling a large artist's paintbrush. She pushed this at my face. I raised my arm several times to deflect her hand. Finally, unwilling to hurt her or interfere with her any further, I let her have her way. She stroked my face with the brush gently and said, like a child, "Isn't it soft?" I looked at her ruined face and said, "Yes, Grandma, it's soft." Out from behind her stepped an old white bear. It stood to her right, to my left. We were all beside the pool. The bear was old, like little dogs get old. It could not see very well, seemed miserable, and behaved unpredictably. It started to growl and wave its head at me, just like little mean dogs growl and look just before they bite you. It grabbed my left hand in its jaws. We both fell into the pool, which was by this time more like a river. I was pushing the bear away with my free hand. I yelled, "Dad, what should I do?" I took an axe and hit the bear behind the head hard a number of times, killing it. It went limp in the water. I tried to lift its body onto the bank. Some people came to help me. I yelled, "I have to do this alone." Finally, I forced it out of the water. I walked away, down the bank. My father joined me and put his arm around my shoulder. I felt exhausted, but satisfied. The unknown never disappears. It is a permanent constituent element of experience. The ability to represent the terrible aspects of the unknown allow us to conceptualize what has not yet been encountered and to practice adopting the proper attitude toward what we do not understand. From the Nag Hammadi Library. For I am the first and the last. I am the honored one and the scorned one. I am the whore and the holy one. I am the wife and the virgin. The positive aspect of the matrix of all being, the twin sister of Kali, so to speak, stands in marked contrast to the terrible mother. The beneficial unknown is the source of eternal plenitude and comfort. It is positive femininity, metaphorically speaking, that constitutes the ground for hope itself, for the faith and belief in the essential goodness of things necessary to voluntary maintenance of life and culture. The beneficial sister has in consequence acquired breadth and depth of metaphoric mythic representation equivalent to that of the terrible mother. The beneficent aspect of the matrix of all things, the eternally fecund virgin, because eternally renewed, the mother of the Savior, is the embodiment of the helpful source, a constant aid to painful travail, tragic suffering, and existential concern. Redemptive knowledge itself springs from the generative encounter with the unknown, from exploration of aspects of novel things and novel situations, is part of the potential of things, implicit in them, intrinsic to their nature. This redemptive knowledge is wisdom, knowledge of how to act, generated as a consequence of proper relationship established with the positive aspect of the unknown, the source of all things. Wisdom is radiant and unfading, and she is easily discerned by those who love her, and is found by those who seek her. She hastens to make herself known to those who desire her. He who rises early to seek her will have no difficulty, for he will find her sitting at his gates. To fix one's thought on her is perfect understanding, and he who is vigilant on her account will soon be free from care, because she goes about seeking those worthy of her, and she graciously appears to them in their paths and meets them in every thought. The beginning of wisdom is the most sincere desire for instruction, and concern for instruction is love of her, and love of her is the keeping of her laws, and giving heed to her laws is assurance of immortality, and immortality brings one near to God. So the desire for wisdom leads to a kingdom. Wisdom of Solomon of the Apocrypha, 6:12-20. Also, therefore I prayed, and understanding was given me. I called upon God, and the spirit of wisdom came to me. I preferred her to scepters and thrones, and I accounted wealth as nothing in comparison with her. Neither did I liken to her any priceless gem, because all gold is but a little sand in her sight, and silver will be accounted as clay before her. I loved her more than health and beauty, and I chose to have her rather than light, because her radiance never ceases. All good things came to me along with her, and in her hands uncounted wealth. I rejoiced in them all, because wisdom leads them. But I did not know that she was their mother. I learned without guile, and I impart without grudging. I do not hide her wealth, for it is an unfailing treasure for men. Those who get it obtain friendship with God, commended for the gifts that come from instruction. May God grant that I speak with judgment and have thought worthy of what I have received, for he is the guide even of wisdom, and the corrector of the wise. Wisdom 7:7-15. Wisdom may be personified as a spirit who eternally gives, who provides to her adherents unfailing riches. She is to be valued higher than status or material possessions, as the source of all things. With the categorical inexactitude characteristic of metaphoric thought and its attendant richness of connotation, the act of valuing this spirit is also wisdom. So the matrix itself becomes conflated with, that is, grouped into the same category as, the attitude that makes of that matrix something beneficial. This conflation occurs because primal generative capacity characterizes both the source of all things and the exploratory slash hopeful attitudes and actions that make of that source determinate things. We would only regard the latter, the subjective stance, as something clearly psychological, as something akin to wisdom in the modern sense. The former is more likely to be considered external from our perspective, something beyond subjective intervention. But it is the case that without the appropriate attitude, the unknown is a sterile wasteland. Ask, and it shall be given you. Seek, and ye shall find. Knock, and it shall be opened unto you. For every one that asketh, receiveth, and he that seeketh, findeth. And to him that knocketh, it shall be opened. Matthew 7:7-8. Expectation and faith determine the response of the unknown, as courageous approach eliminates anticipatory anxiety, and exploration makes the unexpected something valuable. So the indiscriminate categorization characterizing these passages has its worth. We are motivated to protect the products of our exploration, our familiar territories, because unexplored phenomena are intrinsically meaningful, and that meaning is apt to show itself as threat. The probability that the meaning of unexplored territory will be threat, however, appears to be a function of the interpretive context within which it makes its appearance. If the unknown is approached voluntarily, which is to say, as if it is beneficial, then its promising aspect is likely to appear more salient. If the unknown makes its appearance despite our desire, then it is likely to appear more purely in its aspect of threat. This means that if we are willing to admit to the existence of those things that we do not understand, those things are more likely to adopt a positive face. Rejection of the unknown, conversely, increases the likelihood that it will wear a terrifying visage when it inevitably manifests itself. It seems to me that this is one of the essential messages of the New Testament, with its express, although difficult to interpret, insistence that God should be regarded as all good. The beneficial aspect of the unknown is something unavailable to the unworthy, something eternal and pure, something that enters into relationship with those who are willing from age to age, and something that makes a friend of God. The unknown is also something that may be conceptualized using sexual symbolism, something that may be known in the biblical sense. Joined with us, as with a bride, she produces all things that are good. I learned both what is secret and what is manifest. For wisdom, the fashioner of all things, taught me. For in her there is a spirit that is intelligent, holy, unique, manifold, subtle, mobile, clear, unpolluted, distinct, invulnerable, loving the good, keen, irresistible, beneficent, humane, steadfast, sure, free from anxiety, all-powerful, overseeing all, and penetrating through all spirits that are intelligent and pure and most subtle. For wisdom is more mobile than any motion. Because of her pureness, she pervades and penetrates all things. For she is a breath of the power of God and a pure emanation of the glory of the Almighty. Therefore, nothing defiled gains entrance into her. For she is a reflection of eternal light, a spotless mirror of the working of God and an image of His goodness. Though she is but one, she can do all things, and while remaining in herself, she renews all things. In every generation she passes into holy souls and makes them friends of God and prophets. For God loves nothing so much as the man who lives with wisdom. For she is more beautiful than the sun and excels every constellation of the stars. Compared with the light, she is found to be superior, for it is succeeded by the night. But against wisdom, evil does not prevail. She reaches mightily from one end of the earth to the other, and she orders all things well. I loved her and sought her from my youth, and I desired to take her for my bride, and I became enamored of her beauty. She glorifies her noble birth by living with God, and the Lord of all loves her. For she is an initiate in the knowledge of God and an associate in His works. if riches are a desirable possession in life? What is richer than wisdom, who effects all things? And if understanding is effective, who more than she is fashioner of what exists? Wisdom 7:22-8:6. The terrible unknown compels representation. Likewise, the beneficial unknown. We are driven to represent the fact that possibility resides in every uncertain event, that promise beckons from the depths of every mystery. Transformation, attendant upon the emergence of change, means the death of everything old and decayed, means the death of everything whose continued existence would merely mean additional suffering on the part of those still striving to survive. The terrible unknown, which paralyzes when it appears, is also succor for the suffering, calm for the troubled, peace for the warrior, insight and discovery for the perplexed and curious. Is the redemptive jewel in the head of the toad or in the lair of the fire-belching dragon? The unknown is the fire that burns and protects, the endlessly mysterious transcendent object that simultaneously gives and takes away. The positive aspect of the unknown, incarnated as the many-breasted Greco-Roman goddess Diana or Artemis, mistress of the animals, is portrayed in Figure 35, Unexplored Territory as Creative Mother. Everything that contains, shelters, and produces exists as source for the symbolic representation of, occupies the same category as, this promising element. Fruit, distinctive for its seed-bearing properties, such as the pomegranate or poppy, provides appropriate motif for gravid containment. The pig stands as representative of fertility, and the cow, the holy beast of India, as embodiment of principle of nourishment. Shellfish stand for generation and fertility because of their vulva-like shape. Inanimate items such as boxes, sacks, and troughs contain and shelter, while similar objects such as the bed, the cradle, and the nest are characterized by protective and therefore maternal function. Humanized representations, statuettes of nude goddesses, among the most ancient objects of representation known, appear to represent fecundity and the productive countenance of nature in anthropomorphic form. The creation and subsequent appreciation of such figures perhaps aided individuals and societies in their efforts to clarify the nature of the human relationship to the protective aspect of existence. Makers of such statuettes placed great emphasis on collective, impersonal features of generation, such as breasts, genitals, and hips, features whose functions remain largely outside voluntary control, but devoted little attention to features defining self-conscious individuality, like those of the face. Such figures apparently represented the vessel of life and were rendered in the image of woman, whose body generated human life and nourishment for that life. The body vessel represented beneficial nature itself, as stated by Neumann. All the basic vital functions occur in this vessel-body schema, whose inside is an unknown. Its entrance and exit zones are of special significance. Food and drink are put into this unknown vessel, while in all creative functions, from the elimination of waste and the emission of seed to the giving forth of breath and the word, something is born out of it. All body openings, eyes, ears, nose, mouth, navel, rectum, genital zone, as well as the skin, have, as places of exchange between inside and outside, a numinous accent for early man. They are, therefore, distinguished as ornamental and protected zones, and in man's artistic self-representation, they play a special role as idols. The unknown, source of all determinate information, is simultaneously destructive and creative. The terrible aspect of the Great Mother threatens everything with dissolution. Her positive sister is the generative aspect of being. Figure 36, the heavenly genealogy of the destructive and creative mothers, portrays the relationship between the two discriminable sisters, their derivation from the unified but ambivalent unknown, and their ultimate descent from the dragon of chaos. The ability to restrict the appearance of the terrible mother and foster the realization of her benevolent sister, that is, the ability to decrease threat and maximize promise and satisfaction, might well be regarded as the secret of successful adaptation. The existence of representations of the twin aspects of the unknown allowed for practice in adaptation in the face of such representations, allowed for exposure of the individual in imagination and action, in controlled fashion, to potently constructed representations of those things that he or she was destined to fear most, was necessarily most vulnerable to, but which could not be forever avoided. Similar rituals underlie every form of successful modern psychotherapy. Modern treatment for disorders of anxiety, to take a specific example, desensitization, involves exposing an individual ritualistically, that is, under circumstances rendered predictable by authority, to novel or otherwise threatening stimuli with appropriate reaction modeled by that authority. Such desensitization theoretically induces habituation. What is actually happening is that guided exploration in the course of behavior therapy produces reclassification and behavioral adjustment, such that the once terrifying thing or once again terrifying thing is turned back into something controllable, familiar, and known. Voluntary exposure additionally teaches the previously anxiety-ridden individual the non-trivial lesson that he or she is capable of facing the place of fear and prevailing. The process of guided voluntary exposure appears to produce therapeutic benefits even when the thing being avoided is traumatic, when it might appear cruel from a superficially empathic perspective to insist upon exposure and processing. The ritual of voluntary exposure fosters mimetic identification with the hero, whether this is explicitly recognized or not, teaches the individual that the courageous exploratory spirit can eternally prevail over threat. It is this mimetic identification and its abstracted equivalents and consequences that account for the increased general confidence and capabilities that tend to accompany exposure training. The reclassification and behavioral adjustment attendant upon therapeutic exposure places the previously terrible forces of the unknown back under the dominion of knowledge, into the domain of the known, expands explored territory into chaos, places the great mother under the strictures of her consort, culture, the great father. This is exploration predicated creation of the cosmos from the pre-cosmogonic chaos, and the fostering of implicit identification with the logos, the creative and redemptive word. Analysis of the much more dramatic, very widespread, but metaphorically equivalent phenomena of the sacrificial ritual, a rite whose very existence compelled one insightful author, Arthur Koestler, to argue for the essential insanity of man, provides additional insight into the nature of the ability to transform threat into promise. We have already discussed the fact that the valence of an object switches with context of interpretation. It is knowledge of this idea that allows for comprehension of the meaning of the sacrificial attitude. The beautiful countenance of the beneficial mother is the face the unknown adopts when approached from the proper perspective. Everything unknown is simultaneously horrifying and promising. It is courage and genius and the grace of God that determines which aspect dominates. The uncontrollable strength and bloodlust of the bull is the power which, when domesticated, serves to foster, protect, and engender the herd. The devastating power of sudden explosive combustion is reliable and efficient transportation when appropriately harnessed. The Gorgon of nature is helpmistress when approached by the brave, the honest, and the humble. Primary religious rituals, serving a key adaptive purpose, predicated upon knowledge of proper approach mechanisms, evolved to suit the space surrounding the primary deity, embodiment of the unknown. The ubiquitous drama of human sacrifice, prototypical of primordial religious practice, enacted the idea that the essence of man was something to be offered up voluntarily to the ravages of nature, something to be juxtaposed into creative encounter with the terrible unknown. The offering, in ritual, was often devoured, in reality or symbolically, as aid to embodiment of the immortal human spirit, as aid to incorporation of the heroic process. Such rituals were abstracted and altered as they developed, with the nature of the sacrificial entity changing, with constancy of underlying ideation. As late as 1871 in India, the festival honoring the Great Mother in the guise of Durga or Kali was accompanied by the daily slaughter of 20 buffalo, 250 goats, and 250 pigs. The blood-drenched sand in the sacrificial pits was replaced twice a day, removed and buried in the earth to ensure fertility. The slaughter of animals is a relatively late development from the psychohistorical viewpoint, and is generally preceded by and stands in place of the ritual sacrifice of human victims. The Indologist Heinrich Zimmer states, "In her hideous aspect, the goddess as Kali, the Dark One, raises the skull full of seething blood to her lips. Her devotional image shows her dressed in blood red, standing in a boat floating on a sea of blood. In the midst of the life flood, the sacrificial sap, which she requires that she may, in her gracious manifestation as the World Mother, bestow existence upon new living forms in a process of unceasing procreation, that as World Nurse she may suckle them at her breasts and give them the food that is full of nourishment." An ancient conception, extending back as far as the Stone Age. Nature must at every step be given a helping hand. Even she can accomplish nothing by herself. She is no more self-sufficient than man. Nothing takes place of itself, either in the cosmos or in human beings. Man must perform clamorous rites in order to liberate the moon from the clutches of the eclipse, to dispel its demons. And if the sun is to be released from its winter feebleness and rise ever higher with the rising year, a young girl symbolizing the sun must swing higher and higher into the sky. In order to bear fruit and nurture life, the Earth Mother demands to be fertilized and strengthened by potations of blood, the vital fluid. The mysterious and seemingly irrational sacrificial ritual actually dramatizes or acts out two critically important and related ideas. First, that the essence of man, that is, the divine aspect, must constantly be offered up to the unknown, must present itself voluntarily to the destructive creative power that constitutes the Great Mother, incarnation of the unpredictable, as we have seen. And second, that the thing that is loved best must be destroyed, that is, sacrificed, in order for the positive aspect of the unknown to manifest itself. The former idea is predicated on the notion that the unknown must be encountered voluntarily for new information to be generated, for new behavioral patterns to be constructed. The latter idea is predicated on the observation that an improper or outdated or otherwise invalid attachment, such as the attachment to an inappropriate pattern of behavior or belief, turns the world into waste by interfering with the process of adaptation itself. Rigid, inflexible attachment to inappropriate things of value, indicative of dominance by a pathological hierarchy of values, a dead god, is tantamount to denial of the hero. someone miserable and useless in the midst of plenty, just for the sake of illustration, is unhappy because of his or her attachments to the wrong things. Unhappiness is frequently the consequence of immature or rigid thinking, a consequence of the overvaluation of phenomena that are, in fact, trivial. The neurotic clings to the things that make her unhappy, while devaluing the processes, opportunities, and ideas that would free her if she adopted them. The sacrifice of the thing loved best to appease the gods is the embodiment in procedure of the idea that the benevolent aspect of the unknown will return if the present schema of adaptation, the ruling king, is sufficiently altered, that is, destroyed and regenerated. An individual stripped of his identification with what he previously valued is simultaneously someone facing the unknown, and is, therefore, someone unconsciously imitating the hero. The voluntary stripping of such identity makes the supplicant into a new man, at least if the sacrifice was genuine. This is not to say that such ideas cannot degenerate into meaningless, empty, and cruel ritual. The intimate relationship between clinging to the past, rejection of heroism, and denial of the unknown is most frequently explicated in narrative form. Perhaps because the association is so complex that it has not yet been made explicit. The following fairy tale, a wake-up call from the psychoanalytic unconscious, may serve as useful exemplar. It occurred spontaneously to me in a single piece while I was trying to help a man I knew who was undergoing a psychological crisis. His attachment to the unnecessary and superfluous was putting his future in serious danger, but he would not admit this. I wanted to warn him that he would eventually pay a great price for his short-sightedness. He ignored the story, however, at least in the short term, with predictable results. Cock-a-doodle-doo. Once upon a time, there was a man who had a long, hard journey ahead of him. He was trudging along the way, over the boulders and through the brushes, when he saw a little shiny gnome with big white teeth and a black toupee sitting by the side of the road. He was drumming on a log with two white bones and humming oddly to himself. The little gnome said, "John, why work so hard? Why walk so fast? Who knows if you'll ever get there anyway? Come over here. I have something to show you." So John walked off the road. He was sick of walking anyhow, because people kept throwing sticks and stones at him. The little gnome said, "I have a shiny red jewel I would like to sell you. Cheap. Here it is." And from beneath his cloak he pulled the biggest ruby that the man had ever seen. It must have weighed 100 pounds, and it shone like the sun. The gnome said, "Do you like it? It is an enchanted stone. What will you offer me for it?" And the man said, "I don't have much money, but I will give you everything I have." The gnome looked displeased, so John added, "I could pay some more monthly." So the gnome accepted. "Fair enough. Buy now, pay later. Sounds good to me. I'm all for the installment plan." So the man gave the gnome all his money and promised to pay the rest later. And the gnome walked back into the bush by the road, clacking his teeth and giggling and twitching. The more the man thought about his ruby and the great deal he got, the happier he became. He started back on the road with a light heart, but soon discovered that he couldn't make much progress, because 100 pounds was a lot to carry. He said to himself, "Why continue anyway? I have what I want. Why don't I just stand here holding my ruby? And when people walk by, they can see how well I have already done." So he stopped. A little while later, one of his friends came along and saw him standing there. His friend said, John, why don't you come along with me? I have just opened a new business, and I could really use some help. Come along, quick. It will be opening soon. John thought that sounded good, but his friend was in a hurry. Besides, couldn't he see the ruby? How could he speed along beside him? Where would he put his jewel? So he said, "Thanks, but I have to take care of my jewel. Maybe I'll see you later." His friend looked at him like he was crazy, but he was trying to get somewhere quick. So he just shrugged a bit and said, "Okay, John, see you later," and he sped on down the road. A little while later, another friend came by, and he said, "John, nice to see you. I am going back to school. There are lots of wonderful things to learn, lots of great things to do. The world is full of unsolved problems. I could use some company. Would you like to come along?" John thought that sounded pretty good. But this friend, too, looked like he was in a hurry. Besides, standing beside the road holding the jewel was tiring, and he needed all the energy he had for that. So he said to his friend, "Thanks, but I have to take care of my jewel. Isn't it beautiful? Maybe I'll see you later." His friend looked at him like he was crazy, but he was trying to get somewhere quick, so he just shrugged and said, "Hope everything goes all right with you. See you later." Many friends came and went, and the years went by. The jewel got heavier and heavier, but the man got more and more attached to it. The only thing was, nobody seemed to notice how beautiful it was. People would rush by and talk about their plans. And nobody had a ruby as big, and nobody seemed likely to get a ruby as big. So you'd think that someone might have said something. Something at least like, "Nice ruby, John. Sure wish I had one like that." But it never happened. Then one day, someone new came down the road. He was bent over, and he was thin, and his hair was gray, although he did not look that old. He was carrying a big, dirty rock carefully in his arms, and he was not making much progress. The strange figure approached and glanced up at John. Then he grinned and said, "Why are you standing there stupidly with a big, ugly rock in your tired old hands? You look pretty daft. I bet you wish you had a big ruby like the one I am carrying." And John thought, "This poor man is deluded. He is carrying a rock. It is I who have the ruby." So he said, "Excuse me, sir, but you are sadly mistaken. I am the one with the jewel. I met a little gnome by the side of the road, and he sold it to me. I am still paying for it, although not so very much. You are carrying a rock." The tired stranger looked annoyed. He said, "I don't know what game you are playing, mister. You have a rock. I have a jewel. The little gnome you described sold it to me, and he said it was the only one. I have been carrying it for 20 years, and I will never let it go." And John said, "But I have been carrying mine for 20 years, too. It can't be just a rock." Rock or jewel? On and on they argued. Suddenly, out stepped the little gnome, as if he had never left. Only this time he wasn't so little. He was bigger and redder and menacing, and his laugh sounded like the rattling of chains. "Quit arguing, you two. I've never seen a sight quite so pathetic. You're carrying rocks, both of you, and if you ever would have had the sense to put them down for a second or two, you would have seen that. Oh, well, at least you were diligent, and I played a mean trick. I feel bad. So I'm going to give you what you really deserve. Do you want what you really deserve?" And John and the thin stranger nodded eagerly. Finally, they thought. "You haven't seen anything yet. Throw down your rocks." So John and the thin stranger obeyed. Each rock split down the middle when it hit the ground. Out flowed a river of ravenous white worms, which rushed toward the men and devoured them whole, while they thrashed about and screamed. Soon, nothing was left except a leg bone from each. The little gnome picked them up and walked off the road. He sat down by a hollow log and started to drum. He drummed, and he waited, and he hummed an odd little tune. Picture of food feeds the whole hungry clan. The image of good makes the whole healthy man. Why walk the mile? Why do the work? Just smile the smile. Success, after all, is a quirk. Life isn't real. That's the message I give. It's easy that way. Plus, who wants to live? It is ideas of the necessity of sacrifice that underlie, for example, the well-known but explicitly incomprehensible ritual of Christian communion. More accurately, the ritual of the Christian communion serves as one behavioral precursor for these explicit ideas. The Christian hero, Christ, is the spirit who offers himself voluntarily to the cross, to the grave, to suffering and death, to the terrible mother. Such a spirit is, above all, humble, which is a very paradoxical term in this context. Arrogance is belief in personal omniscience. Heroic humility set against such arrogance means recognition of constant personal error, conjoined with belief in the ability to transcend that error, to face the unknown, and to update fallible belief in consequence. Humble, therefore, means greater than dogma, as the spirit of man is a higher power than the laws which govern his behavior. Christ's body, represented in the communion ritual by the ever-resurrecting wheaten wafer, is the container of the incarnate spirit of the dying, reborn, and redemptive deity. This body is ritually devoured, that is, incorporated, to aid the ritual participants in their identification with Christ, the eternally dying and resurrecting Son God. Construction of this awful ritual meant furtherance of the abstract conceptualization of a permanent structural aspect of every human psyche, the heroic aspect, the Word, as active, individually doomed yet mythically eternal, destined to tragic contact with threat and promise of unknown, yet constant participant in the creative, adaptive, redemptive process. The ritual act of exposure is held simultaneously to placate or minimize the cruel aspect of nature and to allow for establishment of contact with the beneficent. From the modern perspective, it might be said, much more abstractly, that voluntary, cautious, careful, exploratory encounter with the threatening and unknown constitutes the precondition for transformation of that unknown into the promising, or at least the mundane, as a consequence of shift in behavior or interpretation. We moderns interpret this change in experience as alteration in subjective state. The pre-experimental mind, less capable of clearly differentiating subject from object, more concerned with the motivational significance of the experience, observes instead that the fear-inducing character of the object has receded as a consequence of the courage of the explorer or the benevolence of the thing in question. Ritual sacrifice was an early, pre-abstract behavioral variant of the idea of heroism, of belief in individual power. The acting out of the idea that voluntary exposure to the unknown, or dissolution of the most favored thing, constituted a necessary precondition, one, for the emergence of the beneficial goddess, and two, for continued successful adaptation. Incorporation of the sacrificial individual in actuality, in ritual cannibalism, or in religious ceremony, in the Mass, for example, meant assimilation of the culture hero. Such incorporation was a pre-conscious attempt to embody the heroic essence, to fortify the constituent elements of the community against paralyzing fear of death and darkness, to fortify the individual and the social group against fear of the unknown itself. The sacrificial ritual was acting out of the hero. Before such acting out could be represented in abstraction, in drama, in story. More abstract narrative representation of the target of the heroic sacrifice then came to portray the emergence of the beneficent goddess, capable of showering reward upon man, her eternal lover and child. The spirit forever willing to risk personal, more abstractly, intrapsychic, destruction to gain redemptive knowledge might be considered the archetypal representative of the adaptive process as such. The pre-experimental mind considered traumatic union of this masculine representative with the destructive and procreative feminine unknown a necessary precedent to continual renewal and rebirth of the individual and community. This is an idea precisely as magnificent as that contained in the Osiris-Horus myth, an idea which adds additional depth to the brilliant moral hypotheses contained in that myth. The exploratory hero, divine son of the known and unknown, courageously faces the unknown, unites with it creatively, abandoning all pretense of pre-existent absolute knowledge, garners new information, returns to the community, and revitalizes his tradition. It is to this more complete story that we now turn our attention. The Divine Son, images of the knower, the exploratory process. Awake, awake, put on strength, O arm of the Lord. Awake, as in the ancient days, in the generations of old. Art thou not it that hath cut Rahab and wounded the dragon? Isaiah 51:9. The great androgynous dragon of chaos is also the mythic figure who guards a great treasure hidden in the depths of a mountain, or who conceals a virgin princess in his lair. He is the fire-breathing winged serpent of transformation, the undescribable union of everything now discriminated, who constantly schemes to take back what he produced. The great and terrible mother, daughter of chaos, destroys those who approach her accidentally, incautiously, or with the inappropriate attitude, but showers upon those who love her and who act appropriately all good things. The great and terrible father, son of chaos, gives rise to sons of his own, but then attempts to crush or even to devour them. He is preconditioned for existence, but impediment to its successful elaboration. What might possibly constitute the appropriate pattern of action in the face of such permanent and multifarious contradiction? The fundamental act of creativity in the human realm, in the concrete case, is the construction of a pattern of behavior which produces emotionally desirable results in a situation that previously reeked of unpredictability, danger, and promise. Creative acts, despite their unique particulars, have an eternally identifiable structure because they always take place under the same conditions. What is known is extracted, eternally, from the unknown. In consequence, it is perpetually possible to derive and rederive the central features of the meta-pattern of behavior, which always and necessarily means human advancement. Human beings are curious about the structure and function of everything, not least themselves. Our capacity to tell stories reflects our ability to describe ourselves. It has been said that Freud merely recapitulated Shakespeare. But it was Freud's genius, despite his manifold errors, to bring what Shakespeare portrayed dramatically up one level of abstraction toward the philosophical or even the empirical. Freud moved information about behavior from the implicit narrative to the explicit theory, or at least to the more explicit theory. Shakespeare performed a similar maneuver, like all storytellers, at a more basic level. He abstracted from what was still behavioral, from what had not even yet been captured effectively in drama. During exploration, behavior and representational schema are modified in an experimental fashion, in the hopes of bringing about, by ingenious means, whatever outcome is currently envisioned. Such exploration also produces alteration of the sensory world, since that world changes with shift in motor output and physical locale. Exploration produces transformation in assumption-guiding behavior and in expectation of behavioral outcome, produces learning in knowing how and knowing what mode. Most generally, new learning means the application of a new means to the same end, which means that the pattern of presumptions underlying the internal model of the present and the desired future remain essentially intact. This form of readaptation might be described as normal creativity and constitutes the bulk of human thought. However, on rare occasions, ongoing activity, specifically goal-directed or exploratory, produces more profound and unsettling mismatch. This is more stressful and more promising, and necessitates more radical update of modeling, necessitates exploration-guided reprogramming of fundamental behavioral assumption and associated episodic or semantic representation. Such reprogramming also constitutes creativity, but of the revolutionary type generally associated with genius. Exploration is therefore creation and recreation of the world. The generation of new information from contact with the unknown means the construction of experience itself. The destruction of previous modes of adaptation and representation, previous worlds, means return of explored territory to the unexplored condition that preceded it, and then its restructuring in more comprehensive form. This is encounter with the great and terrible mother, and death and resurrection of the son and the father. A new manner of dealing with, that is, behaving with regard to, or classifying, an emergent unknown, is the gift of the hero. This gift demands to be given, compels communication, either directly, say in the form of immediate imitation, or indirectly, in the form of abstract description or narrative. There is no real qualitative distinction between transformation of means and transformation of ends, as we have seen. What constitutes ends at a lower level of analysis becomes means at a higher level. It follows that the gift of the hero constitutes normal and revolutionary adaptation simultaneously. Normal adaptation, as schemas of action and representation are extended such that the unknown is rendered beneficial. Revolution, as the old is restructured to allow place for the new. This restructuring is equivalent to the establishment of peace. The peace characterizing the mythic paradise where the lion lays down with the lamb. Such peace emerges as a consequence of the hierarchical organization of the gods of tradition under the dominion of the hero. This means that the creative exploratory hero is also peacemaker in his complete manifestation. I dreamed that I was standing in the grassy yard of a stone cathedral on a bright, sunny day. The yard was unblemished, a large, well-kept green expanse. As I stood there, I saw a slab of grass pull back under the earth like a sliding door. Underneath the door was a rectangular hole that was clearly a grave. I was standing on an ancient graveyard whose existence had been forgotten. A medieval king dressed in solid armor rose out of the grave and stood at attention at the head of his burial site. Similar slabs slid back one after another in numerous places. Out of each rose a king, each from a different period of time. The kings were all powerful in their own right. Now, however, they occupied the same territory. They became concerned that they would fight, and they asked me how this might be prevented. I told them the meaning of the Christian wedding ceremony. A ritual designed to subjugate the two central participants to the superordinate authority of Christ, the Christian hero, and said that this was the way to peace. If all the great kings would bow voluntarily to the figure of the hero, there would be no more reason for war.